on entitled How We Should Study the Bible and Why It Matters. Our speaker tells me that he's a laid-back person, so I'm going to give a laid-back introduction that will befit him, and we've been asked to give brief introductions at any rate. Okay. I assume the importance of our topic doesn't require discussion, how we should study the Bible and why it matters. I'll just mention an anecdote briefly. I gave a Vartora a couple of weeks back, and someone afterwards came up to me and expressed surprise that I had spoken about the psukim. Now, one might think that would be a fairly obvious thing to do in giving a Devar Torah, but as we know, much of the discussion that surrounds biblical texts often focuses on elaborations of the psukim, such as we find it in Midrash or Mefarshim, and of course that has its place. But when one looks at the psukim themselves, it often yields very different results and points to the question of the importance of how we study the Bible, and then raises the question of why it matters. Rabbi Liebtag tells me that he also may have occasion to address the question that interests me, which is why we neglect a study of the Bible. At any rate, however we pose the question, we certainly have a speaker who's well-equipped to address our questions. Rabbi Liebtag is a master teacher who has been teaching Torah for over 20 years. He's the founder of the Yeshivat Har Etzion Virtual Beit Midrash and its Tanakh Study Center, and is one of the pioneers of Torah education via the Internet. His weekly Internet shiur is read by thousands of subscribers worldwide. He teaches at Yeshivat Har Etzion and other institutions in Israel. And so without further ado, I'm happy to be able to invite him to speak to us on this topic. Rabbi Liebtag.
Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for coming in the rain. I want to begin with a little story, which I think will hopefully clarify my main point. It's a story that I think I heard first from Rav Amital, but it's a classic Hasidic story. A Hasid, probably in Europe, comes to his Rebbe, he's all troubled. Can't sleep, goes going nuts. He goes, Rebbe asks, what's wrong? He goes, tomorrow I have to go to the Tsar, to the, you know, whatever the government then was called, and I have to register my son. And I have to get his official birth document. And I don't know what birth date I'm going to write down. So he says, what's the problem? He says, I don't know whether I should make him a year or two older. Don't make him older so that he won't get drafted. Or a year or two younger so that he'll be able to get a job younger, or get a job. He just says, you know, what date to put down? He's going nuts. So Rebbe asked him, why don't you put down the day he was born? The real date. He says, you know, Rebbe, never thought of that. And it's almost like, probably they made up the story, but the story I think is very true. And my point is as follows, if you didn't catch on. We talk about studying Tanakh. We find so many different disciplines of study. I think the one thing that's lacking is just reading it and trying to understand it. People look for Bible codes. People look for different multiple authors. People look ancient documents. People, the first assumption everyone's making that it's not what it is. And that happens simply too often. And the main point of my lecture is I want to try explain how to read Tanakh as what it is. And I want to suggest a method or an approach which will explain, I think, a healthy, or if you call it what's called renewing the spirit. What's the name of our sentence? Yeah. To renew our spirit. Also renew our approach to study, and based on our moderator's request, one last word of introduction about why Tanakh has taken a back seat. In general, in Jewish education, we're very interested in educating our children, and we only want the best education for our children, and we look for the best school, and we know that there's levels of Jewish learning, and you know, when you start with learning Chumash, and then you get better, you learn Mishnah, and then you learn Gemara, etc. And that becomes sort of a yardstick for excellence in Jewish education. So a dedicated parent goes to a whole list of schools and says, what school should I send my son to? Or my daughter? And they say, what? Okay. Oh, in this school, we start learning Gemara in sixth grade. He said, oh, in our school, we start learning Gemara in sixth grade. And he says, oh, in our school, we get learning in fourth grade. So where do they send a child to? Okay. Wherever. Everything's measured in a chitzoni way. In a chitzoni is a outside, external manner instead of internal. And instead of taking what's the best education that my child needs, we measure our things too much by how they appear on the outside as opposed to what's needed on the inside. So what happens is there's such a emphasis on what's called Talmud education, which is important. Sometimes study of Chumash and Navi gets the back seat. It's identified for something for children, something for, hope I can say, something for women. And indeed, not that I hold from that, but definitely it's viewed that way. You know? And if you want to be really serious and you want to be in with all the social importance of what it means to be part of the Jewish being, you know, being in the learning community, that it's not in to actually pick up a Chumash or a Navi and read the story. And that's something which I'll try to show today, how study of Chumash and Navi can be something which is enlightening or renewing, not just for little kids, but you can learn Navi and Chumash as an adult as well. And it can be morning, and there's no doubt that the Rishonim and the Tanaim, anyone who reads Gemara, actually reads it, realizes that the people who wrote it knew their Tanakh inside out. And the same Rishonim like the Ramban and Rashbam who wrote commentaries, and Rashi for sure, who wrote commentaries on the Gemara, were swimming and they knew their Pesukim and knew their Tanakh inside out as well. And I think it's an aberration in Jewish education. And I think little by little, the schools are doing a little bit better, but I think it's also we're here, most of you I think are out of school already. Maybe you might be teaching in schools. But I want to bring up points which, as adults, how we can approach Torah study. I want to begin with an assumption that I think almost everyone has, which I want to sort of counter. I mentioned in the beginning when the first thing I expect people to do if you read Chumash, simply to read it for what it is, instead of looking for what it's not. You know, everyone wants to be, you know, outsmart, you know, what's it really up to? But any time you read any book, you always have to ask yourself what I call author's intent. Any book that's written by anybody, someone wrote it, it could be even HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I don't want to get into the divine element of Chumash study. But any book that you're reading, someone wrote it, and that person had a certain intent in what's being written. And when you read a book, you always have a certain beginning assumption of what to expect. Like if you pick up a novel, you expect to find something interesting, some drama. You pick up a chemistry book, you expect to be bored. but you need to learn chemistry. Right? You have to learn history of World War II for a project or for school. So you're picking up and you expect to read a history book. Right? You pick up a newspaper, you expect to hear news, right? You read news. What happened? An editorial page, you expect to get comments. The Jewish press, you get them both together. You get them? They have Jewish press there? But my point is, when someone picks up any book in Tanakh, Chumash, Navi, etc., everyone has a certain underlying assumption, but really doesn't define it very well. My own gut feeling is, what I've seen, is when people pick up Chumash and Navi, they have this feeling, I'm reading the history of the Jewish people. And the more, I guess, the more religious you are, the more you believe in it means, the more it's from God, the more accurate and 100% correct it is. But the basic understanding is that this is a book of Jewish history. This is the history of the Jewish people from the time of creation until the destruction until the beginning of the Second Temple. And we have book by book. We have some written by God, some written by prophets, some written, remember, Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim? That's the assumption. My main point is that the books have to be viewed in a bit of a different light. To explain the difference, I want to define two words. Not that I'm defining the word, I'm going to define how I'm going to use the word. It could be that in Webster, they might say it a bit different. I want to use two words simply to clarify what's called in Hebrew a chiluk, or a distinction, to clarify two types of books, two types of literature. There's what we call chronicle. Someone writes a chronicle, as opposed to composition. First, let's explain chronicle. It's very easy. What's a chronicle? When someone, if you take notes in a meeting, or say taking notes in a shir, or someone, you've been in a meeting, someone takes notes. No one likes doing it. But the purpose, the goal of the person taking notes is to record what happened. It's basically a type of historian, a stenographer, even to more extent. That's what a historian does. Now, it's true that a historian might have his own opinion, might have his own slant, and might put his own feelings, opinions into what he writes. But first and foremost, his intention is to give over history. And if you want to reach an opinion about a set of historical events, you read this history book and that history book and that history book, and then you can reach a conclusion. Now, that's what I call chronicle. And I think most people, when they read Chumash, that's the impression that they have, they're reading a type of a chronicle. If we talk about composition, let's go back to those, if you remember your days in school. Remember that? Let's say a teacher came into class and said, okay, class, your assignment is a composition. What happens? Yeah. And what's the overall feeling in the class? Are they happy or sad? In general? Listen, well, how come they're so sad? There's always a nerd or two knows that gets always excited or well. But everyone, any normal kid, his face is down. Why? How is the composition different? If you tell the kid, write 100 times, I'll be good. No, he'll do it. So, or he'll bargain, let me get away with 50. Tell me you have to write a composition? Who? Anything for that. Why? Because you got to think, right? Okay. And when you go up watching TV all the time, someone thinks for you, it's very hard to think for yourself. Now, what's the big hurdle when you write a composition they have to give over, that you get over? The first thing you have to do is, like you said, what am I going to write about? Now, what's my topic? What's my thesis, my topic, my main point? I'm coming to make a point. Then once I have my idea set, then it's easier, then I have to go and prove my point. But what I'm trying to say is, when I say the word composition, in Hebrew, chibur, that the intent of what I'm writing, the purpose of what I'm writing is to make a point. I want to make a point, and to make that point, I'm writing this book. Now, let's take it now to Chumash. My contention is that when we read the books of Chumash and Navi, what we're reading is really chibur, meaning composition, prophetic composition, even though it appears to be history. And it sounds like I'm contradicting what I said in the beginning, read it for what it is. But when you understand what Nevuah means, I think it makes a lot more sense what I'm saying, and then I'll try and prove it to you book by book. When we pick a book of Nevuah, if someone asks the average person, what does the word Nevuah mean? Or what does the prophet do? What do prophets do? Yeah. What do you mean? So give me, what's that mean? Doing what? Perfect. Did I plant that answer? No? I didn't plant it, right? No, okay. Right. If I ask any group of 100 people, 90 will say, a prophet foretells the future. Correct? Okay, if someone knows that the stock market's going to crash, and you said it 2 days before, what do people say? A prophet. In modern English, that's the way the word prophet is used. The word in Hebrew, nevuah, usually we'll find them admonishing. But the word nevuah really means actually speech. A niv is like a saying in Hebrew. Niv tzvatayim is the movement of lips. What do I mean by speech? A navi is very simple. There's this concept of God. Right? Everyone's heard about God. Maybe you read the book. Maybe you didn't read the book. There's a concept of God. And God wants to, at least we believe, he wants to communicate to men. But the communication isn't so simple. Right? There's this transmitter. Like we'll take an analogy from electronics. There's this transmitter transmitting this powerful signal, but there's an inability for the receiver to tune it in. Why? Because they're on different wavelengths. Because that's God and we're human. What's the job of the Navi? What's the job of the prophet? He is the middleman. Not just a conduit, but a sort of a spokesman. He understands what God wants, and he's able to translate what God wants. He understands God, and then he relays that to the people. You follow the idea? I think it's very simple. If we had Chumashim when it was this year, we'd read a beautiful pasuk in Sefer Shemot, Perek Zayin, if someone wants to write it down, chapter 7 in Sefer Shemot, I'm sure you remember the story, God tells Moses, go tell Paro ABCD. Remember? What's Moshe say? Ani arav shpatayim. Meaning what? I'm not, he's not reluctant because he's weak. Saying, I'm not capable, right? I don't have the credentials to do the job. Why? I don't speak clearly. He won't understand what I'm saying. I won't make my point clearly. What's God's solution? Aaron will be what? He says, Aaron achicha yeh nevi'echa. Aaron, your brother, will be your spokesman. You'll be like Elohim to Pharaoh, and Aaron achicha yeh nevi'echa. Aaron, your brother, will be your spokesman. If I want to take an analogy from today, every prime minister or president, you know, big official has a spokesman. Right? The president or the prime minister, I guess, and I'm used to doing this in America. You have the prime minister, isn't it? He's not going to go and speak to the people every day, but he has a spokesman. What's the job of the spokesman? He takes official policy and explains it to the people. It's not his policy, but the the government, the president, the king, prime minister, explains it to him, and he gives it over. Now, who is the president going to choose to be a spokesman? What type of person? We need a lot of qualities. Someone who's eloquent, right? Also someone he can trust, someone who's responsible, someone who can understand something and translate it, someone who can field questions, and also know when to say, I don't know, I have to check with my boss. You follow? And that's why a spokesman for God is a Navi. And therefore, in essence, what's Nevuah? Whenever you have Nevuah, always expect to find a message from God. I think that's the rule of thumb number one. I think it's very simple. But in every book in Nevuah, expect to find a message from God. That's what the book is about. If I'm going to read a comic book, I expect to find something funny. If I'm going to read a chemistry book, I expect to find complicated equations. Or you follow? A science book. If I a history book, I'll find history. If I'm reading Nevuah, expect to find a message from God. That's my first point. And anyone reading any book of Nevuah, and that reading be totally void of a message from God, I think it's missing the point. If all you see is a bunch, it's like a doctor looking at a human being and saying all they see is a bunch of cells, right, and arteries and organs, without even recognizing it's a human being, and that happens in medicine sometimes too often. Realize, first of all, it's a book of a message from God. Now, how does that book give over that message? That's already studied. But at least recognize that the book was written to give over a message. And that's some crazy, what do you call it, redactor, you know, taking ancient documents and pasting them together because they had nothing better to do. I'm exaggerating the university point, which I'll relate to, hopefully, as we go on. Now, then the question is, how does the book make its point? In order to do that, and that's why we get to my first point about study, how do you read a book which is supposed to be making a point, and how do you analyze the book and find what the point is? So some books that come with a jacket on it or a cover, what do you do? If you go to a bookstore and buy, there's a new book out, wonder what's the book about? What point is the author making? You read the jacket. Read the jacket, and the jacket's written by the publisher who wants you to buy the book. It sounds a little bit better. But you get an idea, so you know what you're getting. Chumash doesn't come with a jacket. Okay? Maybe it's a black cat. It comes with a... By the way, do you know what the joke is in the yeshiva world, like people, why they don't learn Chumash, or why they don't learn Tanakh? And any yeshiva, any religious person, before they pick up a book, always, what do they look for? They don't look for the jacket. What do they look for? What's called haskamas. Haskamas are, what's the word in English?
Approbation.
Okay. I learned a new word. Haskama. Haskama means someone, and usually what happens is they write, you know, I didn't have time to read the book, but I know the author, and he's a, you know, he's a Yerush Shamayim, he fears God, etc. Now, a Tanakh doesn't have haskama, doesn't have a, right? No one said it's okay, so, you know, what gives us the right to, what's he going to write? Now, I know the author, but he made the Shamayim, that he's Yerush Shamayim. So, that was sidetracked. back to, how do you take a book, in Chumash, and understand what's its point? If your assumption, this is the history of the Jewish people, that's all it is. But if you understand that God's giving me a message here, there's a message in the book, then you have to ask yourself, how am I going to read this story and take out from it, and understand from it, and deduce from it a message? And that brings us to the world of what's called literary analysis, and the question to what extent we can do that in Chumash. Now, another question always has to be asked is, when was the book written? Because now we went to what was the purpose of the book. Every book was written at a certain time. And then we get into a whole world of biblical scholarship, which I don't want to get into so much of dating the books when they began. But even I'll give an example, the way Chazal understand, the way the rabbis understand, Sefer Breshit. All the books of Chumash. There's something that a lot of people think from the movie that when do we get to Chumash? When do most people think Moshe Rabbeinu got, when did Am Yisrael get to Chumash? At what event? At Har Sinai. And Moshe came down the mountain with what? With the Sefer Torah. Right? That never happened. Right? Chumash as we have it, the five books, aren't until the 40th year. According to Chumash. According to everybody. No one says anything different. At Har Sinai we received the tablets of the covenant, received many laws, and over that year in the desert we got many more laws. We also got the only book that we received at Har Sinai was what? Was the book of Breshit. You follow? The book of Breshit. Remember, the book of Breshit wasn't written by Adam. It wasn't an ongoing diary. Written first by Adam Arishon and then passed it on to Noah, who passed it on to Shet, who passed it to Terach, to Avram. It's not an ongoing diary. The Avot did not have the book of Breshit. The book of Breshit was written when? And given to the people of Israel at Matan Torah. That's rabbinic opinion. Now, why am I making that? Why is that important? When you read Sefer Breshit, you have to recognize that this was a book being written for the people who had already gone out of Egypt, who were about to receive a set of laws that they have to keep in this land. And what do they need to know? Why were they chosen? You follow? There's a purpose in the book. Okay. Now, you're about to command a couple hundred thousand, a couple million people, a set of laws, and you're about to charge them to take over a land and to establish a nation that's going to represent God, and they're going to have a temple and a sign. They're giving them this big job to do and a lot of laws to follow. Before you begin, it only makes sense that you would tell them about what's it all about, what we're doing it for. In light of, when you understand, when you take that in mind, when you read Sefer Breshit, the book takes on a whole new light. And then you have to ask yourself, why is it that Sefer Breshit doesn't begin just with for sure the main topic of the book is God choosing Abraham, and then Isaac, and then Jacob. No, it's choosing the Jewish people. Then you have the question, why does God dedicate so much time in the beginning to all these stories before Abraham is chosen? Why can't I just say Adam and Rishon give birth to... Why can't I just take the genealogies and get right down to Adam? Why do I need to about... What do I care if Cain killed Hevel? They're gone. What do I care about if the people built some tower? And what do I care about if all mankind... They're all destroyed anyhow. And why do I need to know that... Well, some of Cain's chosen, this guy built a city. What's it to do with the Jewish people? If it's just to know where we come from, what do we gain? On the other hand, if you take the book thematically and say, I have two sections of the book. The first section being story after story. A set of stories before Abram is chosen that all discuss a common theme of God being upset with man's behavior, or mankind's behavior, and punishing them. And that cycle going over and over again, that sets up a foil to understand why Abram was chosen. Let me give some big example, explain what I was saying there. One way to interpret Sefer Breshit, what's the reason why I have the story of creation, not just the story of creation, but also the story of how God puts man in Gan Eden, but he fails. God's unhappy with man's behavior in Gan Eden. Has to punish him. God's unhappy with Cain's behavior. We have the classic, case of murder. Cain has to be punished. God's unhappy with all mankind, because there's a corruption. The generation of the flood needs to be punished. God's unhappy with the builders of the Tower of Babel. They have to be dispersed. Right? We have story after story, right, of God's unhappiness with mankind's behavior. And then we have a switch of topic to God choosing a Jewish nation and charging him and putting him through different tests and different... and enters the covenant with him. So what a lot of commentators like Sforno and Ramban and many others, what do? They take that set of stories, they analyze it, and reach what conclusion? They reach the conclusion that the reason why God chose a Jewish nation was to help what's called Tikkun Olam, in order to put mankind back in a proper direction. You follow the difference between the two approaches? If I just say, the book of Breshit, here's what happened. It just so happened, the Gan Eden story. It just so happened, Cain killed Hevel. It just so happened, these guys built a tower. It just so happened, God told Avram to make Aliyah, etc., etc. So I have a history book. If I understand it as a chibur, as a composition, then the reason why the stories are there is to come to explain me why we're chosen. Now, saying it's a competition doesn't mean the stories aren't true. It has nothing to do with whether the stories are true or not. It's a totally different topic. But it at least enables a serious discussion whether the story is written to make a point, right? How important is the validity of the story? How important are its details in making a point? But that's a topic for a whole totally different, that's Torah in trouble, not Torah in motion, I guess. that's a serious discussion of is it permitted within Judaism to say, you know, maybe the Tower of Babel really never happened the way it's described, but the story's coming to teach you something about it. I don't want to get into all that. But once you understand it as composition, that enables a serious discussion about that possibility. Now, I simply want to bring one example of how looking at Sefer Bereshit, for example, would be much more meaningful if we take into consideration when it's being written, and it's being written as a book of Nevuah, a composition to make a point. And therefore, what stories are there? The stories that I need to understand my point. For example, if we had a title day from, I guess a new title for Bereshit might be The Choosing of the Chosen, from Avraham. The title of The Chosen was taken already. So we have The Choosing of the Chosen, meaning, what? No, God chooses Avraham Avinu, and says, you're chosen, all you're separate. What happens next? Oh, not everybody, Yishmael is out, that's out, only Yitzchak. And he tells Yitzchak, oh, you're chosen. Yitzchak has kids, what's God tell him? You know what? Not just not all your kids, just Yaakov, not Esav. First maybe Esav, not Yaakov, then Yaakov, not Esav. Then Yaakov finally has kids from a lot of different wives, and they think only one's chosen, and they start fighting about it. Is it Joseph? Is it not Joseph? They have a whole musical. And, right? And by the time the book's over, what happened? With all that choosing of the chosen, we finally get it straight. We finally know who's Jewish and who's not. These are chosen even though their parents are maidservants, and these are chosen even though he's Ashkenazi, and this one's chosen, right? Right? Each one's chosen, and and from then on, it doesn't make a difference who you are, how you act. You're part of the Jewish nation. Got the idea? Look, I can understand the book of Bereshit as a book about... Now, someone could argue of what the message of the book is, but I want at least everyone to agree that when you read a book, you have to begin to analyze it looking for a theme and looking for a purpose. Now, how do you do that? Simply you have to study and analyze and put the parts together. And a book, because it's prophetic, can have multiple themes. There can be a topic like Masa Avot Simin Labanim, like a lot of the commentators say. Now, within the stories, how the stories are told, might be holding deep, you know, might have deep meaning for future generations. And there might be even codes there, who knows? And that might be there. There's different levels of Torah study. But first and foremost, right, it's a book, what's called Ena Mikra Yotemi De Pshuto, meaning not just the literal translation of the word, but it means that a book is a book, carries a meaning, and has a purpose. I brought an example from Sefer Bereshit. I want to jump to Navi. I want to go back to Chumash. Yeah, we have time still. I want to bring another example from Navi, and a book that you would least think would be a composition, but sounds just like a chronicle. I'll take the first book of Nevi'im, and I want to give you another application to try to clarify my point. Take the book of Yoshua. Everyone's heard of it? Let me summarize for you what you remember, probably. Right? Joshua crosses the Jordan, right? Fights the battle of Jericho. Maybe the Jordan, the water stopped for a little bit. This Achan guy probably gets killed somewhere, or took something and get killed. Then there's something with Givonim. Someone gets dressed up or something with Givonim. And then a couple more battles, and the sun stops in Givon. And then there's a bunch of, what do you call it? A couple more, like, borders or things like that. Pretty much good summary? Unfortunately? Okay. Maybe someone heard of... Okay, that's pretty much Yeshua, but I'll add a little bit. Okay. The book of Yeshua basically talks about how the Jewish people conquered the land. Correct? Conquered the land and then divided up among the tribes. Pretty simple. There's a couple interesting miracles in the beginning and some interesting stories later on. The rest seem to be very detailed. Now, if you look at the book a little more carefully, it seems to contradict itself many times. I'll take just a little poll for those who remember. Right? Was the conquest complete in the time of Yeshua or not? Who says yes? Nobody? Yeah? Okay. What? The book says. Okay. The book says the conquest was complete. Everything was done. Right? The historians will come and tell you what? depending on it, it was far from this. There's almost very little records of no, it wasn't very complete. Okay? But the book also tells you what? It wasn't complete. Yeshua yelled at, like you said, Yeshua yelled at the people, how come you're not finishing your job? So there's some psukim instead for Yeshua that tell you how great the conquest was, how everything was complete and done. And some verses tell you, right, there's tons that was left to be done. It wasn't finished. So you know what they do in university, right? What's an easy solution to the problem? There were two or three different texts of how the Jews, took over the land. Some were pro, right? Some were like saying how great it was, and some were other way, and they make a whole, and then some Mr. R. redactor comes in, you know, weaves them all together into some mishmash document, which contradicts itself all the time, for no reason. Okay. What if you assume that Sefer Yeshua was written for that reason, you have a problem. If you understand the book as a composition, I'll show you how simple it is. It's a whole new way of looking. I want to talk about what's called prophetic need. Okay. In the time of Yeshua, it wasn't a total success. It also wasn't a total failure. There was some success and some wasn't. But whenever you're in a situation where something is a little less than ideal, what do people begin to do? Right? Let's say you didn't. Did they have a World Series here? Or what they have? Playoffs, whatever it is? Any kind of championship. I forgot what sport to pick. Probably get hockey in here. Right? Your team doesn't win the championship. Not last place, not first place. What do they do when the season's over? What do they begin to do? Yeah. And what but if we want to win next season, so what are we going to do? We have to change something. But what? Who? Yeah. But before you start deciding what to do, you have to decide what? You have to analyze to decide what went wrong. Whose fault is it? Now, if you read the Bible superficially, what does God promise us? Did God promise that we'd get the land? Seems to be like black on white. God says, hey, the Jewish people, I'm taking you out of Egypt. You get the promised land on a silver platter. It's all yours. I promised to your forefathers. You won. You're Jewish. Show me your ID card. You get everything you want. Right? What happened? Comes 40, 50 years later. They come in the land. And it's not complete. Who should we blame? Who's the best person or best? Okay. You blame God. God, you made a promise. Like teenagers with parents. You made a promise. You promised me everything. How come I don't have it? Now, that's what I call a situation of prophetic need. The people are saying, God did not fulfill his promise. The people are saying, we failed. We didn't win. We don't have the entire land. We still have enemies. Our situation is not very good. It's not a disaster, but it's not good either. There's a lot of things left. We didn't get what we hoped we'd get. And the people are looking for something to blame. And in Jewish history, it's always easy to blame who? To blame God. He promised everything. Isn't that what Judaism is about? We're chosen people. We get whatever we want. We're special. We're a sacred kid. We're spoiled children. And then we say, hey, it's your fault. Spoil us some more. And Navi, like you mentioned, his job is to set them straight. It's not a fairy tale. And it's not a, what do you call it? We're not supposed to be a spoiled child. We're supposed to be a charred. We're supposed to be a dedicated child with a purpose. And what is the book about? The book is about who's to blame for what went right. And who's to blame for what went wrong, and who's to get credit for what went right? If you look at the opening line and say for Yeshua, it's very simple. God tells Yeshua, right? No, Moshe died, it's time to take over. It says, Kol makom asher tidroch kaf raglechem lechatena. Anywhere where you march and take, what will God do? God will help you. And if you look carefully at the book, again, that would be a whole shiur. If you're bored one day, read it carefully. Read the book and read carefully. What the book always says is, God says in the beginning, from the beginning to the end, God promises wherever you take initiative, I'm there to help you. And what follows in the book? Story after story of how, where the people of Israel took initiative, they were successful. What else does it talk about? All the tribes who didn't take initiative and how they were unsuccessful. And how at the end of the book, Yeshua admonishes them again, how come you're so lazy? Get to work and do something. You follow? So the book is not just a history. That's a plain old history. It's a book with prophetic need. There's a real problem in the time of Yeshua. Who's to blame? What's the prophet need to do? The prophet needs to explain to the people why God is right and you're wrong. There's a song about it called Shirat Hazinu. But that way it can be another Shir. Anyone's heard of Shirat Hazinu? Shirat Hazinu in Chumash? Yeah? Remember it says, Al Hashem Tigmilu Zot, Right? Are you going to blame it on God? Shechet lo, lo banabumam. You think it's his fault that things are going to go wrong? It's the people's fault. Et cetera. Read, if you want, as an introduction, simply read Shiras Hazinu, and that's simply the back. If you read Shiras Hazinu carefully, you'll see that's exactly the pattern that Sefer Yeshua follows. So let me summarize my point. Right? Sefer Yeshua, which appears to be simply a book of a download of history, when you analyze the book, understand its setting, its prophetic setting, you can read it from a totally different light as a work, an important work, a prophetic work, that comes to tell the people how and why, why not to blame God for what wrong, but rather to blame yourself for what wrong. And therefore, it also gives direction what the next generation should do. It's not just a summary, but it's also a charge for the next generation. But hopefully the next generation will learn from that. And if you notice how Sefer Shoftim begins, what happens? Exactly the same topic continues. The Navi says, these people didn't do their job, and a malach comes, an angel comes, and tells the people, admonishes them, and they'll cry. That's called the Bochim. And that's that little story in the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. That was, you follow my example, hopefully, from Chumash? I simply want to bring an example. When you study a book as a prophetic composition, you look at it in a totally different light as opposed to studying it as a work of history. Let me just take the next book, which is much easier to see its composition. Shoftim, you're a little more familiar with, probably, than Yeshua. Shoftim, remember the book of Judges? You know a couple of judges? Yeah, there's Dvorah, and there's Niel, and there's Ehud. There's a lot of really cool stories, good stories. There's also some very sad stories. There's Shimshon, who seems like he's a hero, but little strange stories about him. There's Yiftach, who, with his daughter, remember? Yiftach and Abimelech is this guy who kills all his brothers to become king, makes himself king. Maybe you didn't hear that story. There's this Pilegish B'Givah story at the end of the book. There's a lot of gory stories at the end of the book. There's a lot of... The question, what's the book about? Now, to make a long story short, because we're very limited in time, the book of Shoftim was not written, according to the rabbis, it was written by Shmuel. Now, even when the rabbis say that Shmuel wrote the book, that doesn't mean that Shmuel wrote Shirat Devorah. Who wrote Shirat Devorah? Who wrote the song of Devorah, of Deborah? Devorah, right? And who wrote the story of Ehud? Ehud or somebody in his time. Right? The Davin Navi is not to know what happened 200 years ago. But the Navi, as a leader, Shmuel was a leader, is living in a very critical time. He himself is a leader. And the people want a king, don't they? That's a story I'm sure you remember. In the time of Shmuel, the people want a king. And what does Shmuel say? Yes, king or no king? What? That's what Shmuel tells him? Shmuel tells him, does Shmuel want a king or not? He doesn't want a king. Who's the king? God's the king, right? What does God tell Shmuel to do? Give him a king. A machlokes, right? And there it is, Vashamayim. No, it's not. Shmuel says yes, no king. And God says, give him a king anyhow. And you guide the king. Okay. That's an interesting situation where the people in the political activists are telling a reach. Let me go back a step. In the time of Shmuel, the political situation is very bad. You know why? There's these Plishtim, like ancient time Palestinians, coming in from the coast, taking over the coastal plain. And coming into the lowlands. And even encroaching into the mountain range. Shiloh was destroyed by the Plishtim. They're into the mountain range already. And the Ammonim from Jordan are coming in from the east. And taking them. And the country's in the crunch. And there's even no metalwork even in that time. The economy is terrible. The security is terrible. And the people reach a conclusion that the only... And this is getting worse and worse, progressively worse. And what conclusion did the people reach? There's a very logical reason why our political situation is so bad. Or by our security situation is so bad. What's the reason? Our political setup is terrible. What do we need? What do they have that we don't have? We need a king. Not because we're against God or anything. Common sense, you need a king. A king's got to make an army. A king will make an economy. And we're willing to pay the taxes. We're willing to send our men to battle. Because we have to survive. That's what the people were saying. What's the Nevi coming and telling them? If you think that's the only reason why things are bad, I got news for you. Okay? And therefore, what is Shmuel doing? Shmuel, living for his generation, writing for his generation, has to give a book with a double message. He has to give a message to the people why a king alone will not solve your problem. On the other hand, he has to give a message that without a king, it's also not good. And we have to have a complex situation. And therefore, the first part of the book, he explains why the real reason why you've lost your battles was because you left God. And he brings story after story about how, about the cycle. But afterwards, he brings a lot of stories about why we need a king. Because without a king, kings are also bad. It's hard nowadays to accept that a prophet can give a complex message. Because everything has to be, you know, superficial and simple and black and white. But back then, prophets were allowed to give a complex message. But on the one hand, a king alone won't solve all your problems. On the other hand, without a king, you're also going to be in trouble. And what becomes Shlomo's job in his own life? He does educational reform. He does religious reform. He does political reform. He starts the king. Now, the book in which Shmuel explains that complexity of why, on the one hand, a king won't solve all your problems because you have to be dedicated to God as well. But why, on the other hand, if you don't have a king, situations can get even worse. Right? He explained, we're not going to do that whole book now, but when we study Sefer Shoftim, it's easy to see, it's a beautiful composition, where Shmuel comes and explains the complexity and the background for his appointment of Shaul and later David as a king. You follow? It's a book with prophetic need. That's totally different than reading the book of Shoftim as a history book. You follow? If it's a history book, so, you know, how come it's so lopsided? It also explains how come the stories about Shimshon and Yiftach and Abimelech are so down on them, right? The story about Abimelech is down on them. Down meaning very, very severe, very critical of their behavior. And of Yiftach, very critical, and of Shimshon. And what happens is all the Shoftim up until Gidon are very good. And after Gidon, they all look really bad. But that's part of the theme, if you remember what you were mentioning before. Gidon was asked, do you want to become king? Remember what Gidon said? They told Gidon, hey Gidon, you're such a good shofet, why don't you become king? What did Gidon answer? What you said before. Lo aniyim shobachem, lo bniyim shobachem, Hashemim shobachem. Gidon gave this nice firm answer. You don't need a king, God's your king. What's the result? When the right person become king says no. The result is, we got Abimelech, Yiftach, and Shimshon. Now, there's a point in the book, by its structure, that's telling you that when there's an opportunity for a king, don't say no so fast. And there are times when you need a king. But what type of king do you need? You need a king that will set up a country, set up a monarchy, but also follow God and follow his prophet. And that's exactly what Shmuel does. Shmuel doesn't become king. Shmuel appoints the king and becomes the king's prophet or guide, right, to make sure he goes in the right direction. Okay? So let me summarize. We have 2 minutes left. Okay. I want to summarize, and I want to bring another example. By the way, even the book Chronicles, you know the book of Chronicles way in the back that no one ever reads? If we had time, I'd show you that's also not a chronicle. No, it's a selective history. Just a minute. Everyone, there's the book of Kings. Everyone, Sefer Melachim, we've all heard of. And the book of Chronicles in the back that only people doing research look up. But both books seem to be the same history and a little bit different. Oh, this says that, that says that, you know. It's mentioned a little bit. Okay. But if you look at each book, Yirmiyahu writes Sefer Melachim, why? To explain why the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. He is the prophet at the time of destruction. And he writes, looking backwards, not predicting the future. He writes, analyzing what was the reason why we lost, why the monarchy fell apart and the temple was destroyed. And he gives that explanation with prophetic insight to explain to the people why things are so bad and hope that maybe next time they'll do better. Divrei Hayamim is written in the Second Temple period as the people rebuilding the Second Temple to inspire them from the history of the First Temple, of the things that David HaMelech did, that King David did, to build the temple. So each book, the author of each book has a prophetic agenda and writes a selective history. He selectively quotes from previous documents in order to make a prophetic point. So all the books are basically prophetic compositions using history to make a prophetic point. That's my main contention. And when you understand that the prophet uses history and other prophecies and other information and together forms a book making a prophetic point for his generation, that's how the books originally formed. Now, later on these books became so important, so standard, that later in the Second Temple period they were what's called canonized. And of all the books, we picked Sefer Yeshua and Sefer Shoftim and Sefer Shmuel and Sefer Melachim to form what we call Nevi'im Rishonim, But each book was written by itself. Like when Sefer Shoftim was written, if you remember Harry Potter the Reader? Yeah? So, I forget her name who wrote it. But when she wrote Harry Potter 1, I'm pretty sure she was already had plans for Harry Potter 4. Correct? No, but each book stands alone. That's not how Nevi'im Rishonim work. The person who wrote Sefer Shoftim wasn't planning later to write Sefer Shmuel. It wasn't four books of his series. Each book was written by itself for its own time. And stands alone as a whole book. Later, Chazal picked these four books to form a nice, which appears to be history. But it's not. That's not really accurate. It just so happens they appear to form that way, but that's not why they were written. Each was written for its own purpose. Now, I want to go back and spend a couple more minutes on Chumash, and then we'll answer some questions. Sefer Bereishit, I tried to give an example. I want to skip Sefer Shmot, because Sefer Shmot seems to be a nice story, but it's complicated itself. But in Sefer Shmot, what happens? Sefer Shmot, we come out of Egypt. We come to Har Sinai. What do we receive? The Torah. If it was a plain history book, what should happen? We receive the Torah. We should have all the mitzvot that Moshe got at that time. And finished. What happens instead? We have a very select set of mitzvot that Sefer Shmot records. But most of Sefer Shmot is a story. It's a story about how we received the Torah, how we made a covenant, how we built the Mishkan, how we messed up with the sin of the ego, and how we, despite all that, we still built the Mishkan. The topic being what's called Shechina. There's a big question after we get to Har Sinai, can this marriage work? Right? It's basically a question of, that's the way Chazal understand it. There's this beautiful marriage, there's a crisis, and there's a question, can God and the people of Israel live together?
To continue, please go to side two and...
Egypt, the marriage, and finally stabilizing the relationship. Some of the laws are there, and we have to understand the few laws that are there, we have to understand why they're there. Where do we find the rest of the laws that were given? We have a whole book about laws called Sefer Vayikra, another book of laws called Sefer Dvarim, right? And Bamidbar, if we will talk about it in a minute. I want to take Sefer Vayikra, for example. Sefer Vayikra has very few, it's not a storybook. It's 95% a book of laws. That's why I don't want to embarrass people if they remember what's in Vayikra. Oh, at least you remember the Vayikra, you don't remember much. Why? Because it's laws about what? It's about temple laws and things like that. How to bring korbanot and purity laws and things like that. So there's one parsha in Sefer Vayikra everyone learns. What is it? Kedoshim Tio, because that's down to earth. Now, when you study Sefer Vayikra, it's not just a download of laws. What is it? It's an organized set of laws. It's a book by itself. It begins with laws of certain sacrifices and laws about, how to use the Mishkan, how to use the temple. It's primarily a book that deals with the Mishkan. On the other hand, we do find other laws that don't deal about the Mishkan. When you study the book, what question do you have to ask? Right? How come these laws are... What was the criteria for including laws in the book of Vayikra? Which laws are in and which laws are out? And there must be a reason why these laws, this law follows that law. And why Parshat Kedoshim put there in the middle? Now, what can we learn from that? But my point is, even when you study a book of laws, the structure of those laws, how they're presented, is also meaningful. So the Bible gives over its message, not only in its content, but also in its presentation, in its structure. There's not that explains topics like what's called Ein Mukdam U'Meuchar that bothers every student. Something is out of place, doesn't make sense. What does the commentator say? Oh, there's no order in the Bible. That's not an excuse. That means that the Bible is composition. You follow? When you write a composition, right, then it's okay to put things out of chronological order. Okay? And that's simply another example of how the Bible is built. So let me summarize, and then we'll take questions. But my point is, the books of the Bible, including Chumash, written, and there's nothing wrong with saying it's written by God, that's how God writes them. He writes them as composition. And Nevi'im, written by Nevi'im. And Ketuvim. The books all come, first and foremost, to carry a prophetic message, because they're books of prophecy. And they should be read first and foremost in that way. Now, it's fun to read them looking for Bible codes, looking for hints to know how to invest in the stock market, wanting to know what's going to be in the future. But sometimes when we overdo that, I'm taking one extreme. The other extreme, just looking for, how can I cut this thing into 25 different documents coming from 20 different time periods and figuring out how some guy pasted the whole thing together, I'm exaggerating the other direction. But what almost no one does, read the book. Read the book as a work of literature, right? And how it was transmitted, in my opinion, people make too big a deal about it. If you believe in God, and that he gives a message to man. How God transmits it, that's a technical problem. That's technical. What, if you believe in God, and that God wants to give his message to man, how he transmitted it, right? That's totally technical. There's a whole range of beliefs that you're within. You know, if you want to be within what's called the framework of halacha, or you know, if you believe in God that he gives his message to man through his Nevi'im, how it actually happened? Technicality. Could have been that way, but it doesn't make any difference in the message. If you want to believe it was word for word, this way, word for that, that's all. There's a whole range of opinions, but in my opinion, that's all technicality. As long as you believe it comes from God, and it's been given over. And we sometimes we get too tied up in the technicality parts of things, and aren't looking, go back to my analogy of the patient and the doctor. The doctor's so busy looking at every single organ in the body, doesn't realize there's a human being there. It's a living thing that's coming with a message. And if anyone knows anything about the Bible, the main point isn't it's telling you what's going to be in the future. It's telling you how to act in the present based on the past. It's telling you that it's up to you, and that it's not everything's predetermined, but what happens to you is a function of your deeds. And that's such a basic point, which is simply staring at you when you read the Bible, and totally missing sometimes when it's looked from with too much with a microscope. I'll take some questions now, and then.
We have 5 minutes for questions. No time for speeches.
Okay.
There's a microphone here. If you want to speak into the mic, so that it can be recorded on the tapes that are being made.
There's no questions even. Yeah. Good. By temperament, yeah.
Your words will be immortalized, and thus the answer will be more intelligible to those living on the
page. Of the parsha name of the popular parsha name that appears in the Krot Galot, or Krot Chaim, whatever you choose to use, which parsha name would you say really follow along in this theme and try and give to the different books of the Torah?
A classic, if you want to see it like black on white, Ramban and Sforno, in their introduction to every book of Chumash, tackle exactly that question. Right? No, what do they do? Sforno, they say, here's the book, and what they try to do is, what ties this book together? But both Ramban and Sforno, they have an introduction to every book in Chumash. Before the introduction begins, before the book begins, they attempt to explain what ties the book together, and how it relates to the previous book, in some ways. And during their commentary, they often relate back to that idea, but despite all that, none of the commentaries do it in a modern way of explaining an entire book. So if none of them do it, that's much more, that's the nachal, I think, of our generation, or the last couple of generations, where people deal with a book as a whole. Right? Yeah?
Without sort of expounding on your theme of composition and the message, the one thing that a whole section of parshas, names of events, without seeming to provide any specific nevuah other than one historical context. So I'm just wondering if you could elaborate on your interpretation.
Okay. That seems to be a problem, but in my opinion, when you analyze the book, you can see how those toledot, for example, actually add something. I'll give you just for the fun of it. You know, all those years that we got in this week's Parsha, last week's Parsha, how old everybody was, seems to be totally irrelevant. One of the coolest things is when you add up all the years, it comes down, and you figure out how old Avraham Avinu was. Everyone knows what year he was born. It was 1948, which is like really cute. Avraham comes out, he was born. But more important is that the story of the Tower of Babel happens in 1996, when Avraham's 48. In other words, the fact that Avraham is around when the Tower of Babel story happens, and in light of the Tower of Babel story, Avram is chosen. And then you see beautiful Midrashim talking about how those two are connected. No, it could be, in those type of stories, you might have something, there might be what's called a remez, there might be a hint to a deeper topic. But I'll give you an example. There's this complicated list of the people, of the children of Esav. Right? What do we need it for? Ramban says beautifully, later on in Chumash, what happens? What are we told? We're not allowed to intermarry with the families of Esav. Remember, the attention can't come in. What do we need to know? We need to know who's from their family. So it's simply an introduction. It's a beautiful answer, right? A set of laws that seems to be a set of names seems to be totally irrelevant. But we need to know those names for what it goes. To understand a law later on. The 7 days of creation will come to tell you why we keep Shabbat and the Ten Commandments. So once you understand that Bereshit was given at Matan Torah, when the Torah was given, and you understand a lot of psukim much better, and a lot of detail much better. And like, we go into details about the children of Canaan more though than other children of Ham. And the story of Ham being cursed, etc. Usually you can find, the answer might not be obvious right away, and the thing I want to conclude with this is that Chumash isn't a simple story, it's a very complex one, but the way to find the answer is simply continue learning. What's called hafokhba vafokhba kikulaba. It requires, it's a way of life, and therefore it requires constant learning. And the strength of it is that, like a hologram, that every time you look at it from a different angle, you can find more and more. It's not just something black and white, it's something very deep. And for all different ages. Anyway, I want to conclude thanking you for listening. And
I want to conclude by thanking Rabbi Liebknecht for speaking. Okay. There's much more to be said about the topic. You can.
I think I think my website is on there if you want to read more about this stuff. If you want to learn on your own, so my website there has all the shiurim.